Thanks for joining us at the Canadian Breakpoint, a Canadian infectious diseases podcast by Canadian infectious diseases physicians. I'm Summer Stewart, here with Dr. Rupina Purewal, pediatric infectious diseases physician in Saskatoon. For this episode, we celebrate all things spooky for Halloween, and what's scarier than another pandemic? Today, we welcome back Dr. Kinderchuk to discuss emerging viral diseases. Are we prepared for the next pandemic? Dr. Purewal.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of our podcast, The Canadian Breakpoint. Today, we have a very special guest with us, Dr. Kinderchuk, who is an associate professor and Canada Research Chair in Emerging Virus Pathogenesis in the Department of Medical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, and cross-appointed in the Department of Internal Medicine and the Manitoba Center for Proteomics and Systems Biology, the University of Manitoba. His work focuses on viruses that pose the greatest threat to global health, including Ebola virus, orthopoxviruses, coronaviruses, and influenza viruses. His research program centers on the circulation, transmission, and pathogenesis of emerging viruses. Past and present findings from these investigations will help inform emerging virus therapeutic treatment strategies, outbreak prediction, and preparedness efforts with impacts on both human and animal health. Dr. Kinderchuk leads multiple nationally funded emerging infectious disease research investigations, including One Health emerging zoonotic virus surveillance activities in Canada and Africa. These include as a director for the International Mpox Response Consortium, co-lead for Pillar 2 of the Coronavirus Variants Rapid Response Network, and ongoing investigations on the long-term impacts of Ebola virus infection in disease survivors in West Africa. Today, we'll be talking about more just a broader topic, what he's been doing in terms of his work out in Africa, in terms of emerging viral diseases, and really that one question that many of us probably have, or multiple questions that we have about what are the actions that we're going to take to kind of prevent a pandemic, or what's the future like, what's the preparedness level at this time in terms of in the realm of, you know, being surrounded by emerging viral diseases. So thanks, Dr. Kinderchuk, for coming back on today. And it's always a pleasure to have you.
No, thanks for having me. And now I've got to try and figure out if I'm going to be optimistic or pessimistic with the questions. But we'll see.
And you know what? The one thing we always tell our listeners is that this is for informational purposes only, and it's always evolving. So what we will talk about today may change, and that's completely fine. But I think it's up for discussion, and there's always, you know, in our profession, I think there's always things that are evolving, and we just have to take that into consideration. Today's episode, what I kind of wanted to focus on was your work out in Africa, because you, I think, have done a fantastic and commendable job in terms of the different areas that you've been working out there. And I think it was neat for me to hear it when we had our initial discussions and just hear about all the work that you've been doing out there. And I think it would be nice for some of our listeners who are actually interested in emerging viral diseases and a lot of the prevention work that you're doing out there as well, and surveillance, to kind of hear about and maybe elaborate on kind of the work that you are currently involved in.
Sure. I mean, a big part of it is I work with extremely talented people that often tend to be, you know, leaps and bounds smarter than myself, and keep me motivated in that. And I say that very specifically to my African colleagues. The people are the best in the business. So the program has developed really, you know, since I started at the University of Manitoba, you know, 7 years ago. It really had already kind of been in development prior to that when I was still down at NIH in Bethesda. The key point was kind of in 2014, I had the opportunity to spend some time in Liberia during the West African Ebola virus disease epidemic, really providing diagnostic support kind of as that outbreak started kind of hit its peak in the country. That really changed my perception of research, right? It kind of went from being this very, you know, kind of pragmatic kind of, you know, molecular biology based program, trying to understand, you know, why is one virus, you know, more virulent than the other, and trying to understand the mechanics of it, to suddenly saying, oh, wait, there's a lot of people that get sick from these things, and these diseases look awful when you see them up front. What do we do to try to reduce the impacts? And that's a very simplistic way of saying it. So since that time point, We've tried to get a number of things off the ground. One of the big initiatives that we've been working on has been in regards to continual work with Ebola virus. So in Sierra Leone, one of the pieces that we've been able to get up there has been to work with about 1,000 Ebola virus disease survivors to look at long-term health complications, as well as long-term stigma that's faced by survivors in the community. And I think one of the pieces that's kind of comes out of this that's important is when we often think about, outbreaks and this whole idea of outbreak response, mm-hmm. there's almost kind of this, view of the movie Outbreak, where we come in, you get everything contained, and then everything goes back to normal and things are fine. The reality is very, very different, right? What we've seen in the cohort of individuals that we worked with, a lot of long-term health complications, 6 to 8 years post-recovery. A lot of general health complications. These are all self-reported, but neurological sequelae, eye pain, ear pain. We see some reproductive impacts, certainly menstrual impacts for women. And then, of course, we see a lot of mental health impacts. So a lot of very, very severe depression or chronic depression in survivors, and as well, a lot of perceived stigma from the community. And we see it on the ground, right? There's still kind of that piece of, somebody that survived is not always, kind of welcomed back into communities. So mm-hmm. we've really tried to kind of establish, a program to identify what those needs are, knowing that we're working in a country and in an area of the world that doesn't have the support for the needs that are there. So we've really kind of used this as, first of all, a mechanism to be able to report what this looks like, to be able to put a spotlight on to our Sierra Leone colleagues that have been working on this for a number of years, but also mm-hmm. to try and kind of impart the importance of this to the Ministry of Health in the country, as well as to the broader public health community. And I think it plays back into this idea that, that outbreak was not an isolated incident. We've seen, really nearly annual outbreaks in the DRC. Every year kind of following 2016, the outbreaks are not going away. And this probably doesn't just apply to Ebola, really to any disease that has a high morbidity cost to it. There are probably a lot of these long-term complications that we don't actually know about because we're not investigating them, because the systems aren't present within the community. So that's a big piece of it. The other piece of what we're doing in West Africa has been more about the idea of what happened in 2014. There's December 31st, 2013. There's, this case of a young child that starts showing symptoms, and the contact tracing and the investigations go back to this idea that this child probably had a contact with an infected bat. We think bats are the likely reservoir host mm-hmm. for Ebola virus. The kind of in between gets a little bit more complicated because there are other animal species that can act as intermediate hosts between humans and bats, most notably non-human primates. And if we go back into like the late 90s, early 2000s, some of the data that came out of Gabon by their local researchers and folks from France was that there was actually a pretty high impact of Ebola virus amongst great apes, so both mountain gorillas as well as in chimpanzees. So we know that these animals are potential hosts for the virus, but we don't know much about what it looks like in terms of circulation or how they play a role in ongoing circulation. For us, when we think about Sierra Leone, the virus, kind of came out of, nowhere in 2014 for the first time, the end of 2013, and has really since disappeared outside of recrudescence in Guinea in 2021. These viruses often don't disappear. So they're, the likelihood is that Ebola virus is still circulating somewhere in the wild, but we don't really know where. So we're actually working with a chimpanzee sanctuary called Takugama in Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. The sanctuary serves to rehabilitate chimps that have been either orphaned or injured in the wild, and they bring them in, they rehabilitate them, but also acclimate them back towards non-human contact with chimpanzees that are at the facility. We have been working in partnership with that group for a couple of years now. They do annual health checks on the animals. It's basically a top to bottom health check. The animals are fully sedated. They do everything from digital x-rays to looking for scarring and tissue abnormalities, swabs, blood, urine, feces. So mm-hmm. we've been assisting with those, but also trying to collect sera so we can look for exposures. And really what we see this as an opportunity to do is to be able to better identify where viruses are circulating in the wild. Yeah. So we have that big initiative in DRC. We're actually looking at that. Obviously it applies to Mpox right now, but more broadly, one of the things that we're focusing on is the idea of certainly the wild animal trade, more so in terms of wild game, so that the trading and purchase of meat from local markets. One of the things that we don't really understand is the risk that there is to people in terms of exposures to animal tissues from certainly from species that we know are potential hosts for these different viruses. There has not really been a kind of a thorough study of what do those risks look like? What does testing of those tissues look like in terms of positivity for viruses or emerging infectious diseases? So we're working locally in South Kivu right now with basically acquiring samples from local animal markets. We want to be able to also move into dried blood spot analysis on folks that are involved in hunting to be able to look at those exposures and be able to look at potential risks for humans in terms of consumption or contact with those samples. And then, of course, we do a multitude of other things on the One Health front, but those two are the biggest initiatives that we're undertaking at the moment.
Okay, that's fantastic. Yeah, and definitely, I mean, what we've learned from like the pandemic and then also with even Mpox and the situation, really having like these surveillance networks is important because that is the key to kind of mitigating the risks and disease spread and really finding out where there's high disease areas so that we can focus our efforts there.
Yeah, and it's important for us. Like when we think about, certainly again, going back to West Africa with Ebola, the virus emerged, had devastating consequences, not only in terms of human health, but also obviously economically within the region. Those impacts continue to be felt 10 years later. There's really a need to be able to try and understand for the local communities where, you know, kind of those greatest risks lie in terms of potential exposures, while also kind of appreciating that we can't, you know, certainly with One Health work, we can't go into communities and say, listen, just don't hunt or don't have contact with animals. Right. That will reduce the risk because that's part of their traditional lifestyle and you're not offering anything in terms of sustenance alternative. So a big part of this is being able to try to understand what that exposure risk is, but also to try and work with communities to look for areas to try and reduce the potential for exposure. So are there basic kind of IPC things that we can do and we can work with communities on, or be able to try to promote and engage people for self-reporting or trying to increase diagnostic capacity in the area so that we have earlier detection of when these events occur?
Yeah, so it sounds like awareness is a key component of this, right? And then, so if they are engaging in activities which can increase disease activity, then they know from the infection prevention control, handling, meat handling, those types of practices, so that they can kind of mitigate the risk of spread of the disease.
Yeah, and of course, and still the caring of patients locally, right? Whether it's within a household or within a local healthcare clinic, you know, being able to try and provide at least some recommendations to reduce risks where we can or where we can provide information on.
No, that's fair. Yeah, and what I've like, you know, seen in our practice over the years, and even when, you know, we had local centers preparing for any Ebola cases that were travel related, there was definitely like infection prevention control was the forefront of everything, right? In that terms as well. But I think the most important thing was just being aware that these are the high risk areas. Yep. So if travel was coming from there, and if anybody had really, I mean, fever was one of the main signs. And if they had fever and they were coming and they traveled from this area, then the protocols were initiated. And I think that probably controlled most of the situation within most countries outside of the endemic areas.
Yeah. And I think coming through COVID, I mean, I was in, kind of living in Frederick, Maryland at the point where I was in Liberia. I came back into the U.S. from my deployment the day that the first U.S. case was announced. Things changed, and there was a lot of local concern about what that meant. I think where we were then versus where we are now, we know a lot more about the importance of infection prevention control, but also the importance, I think, for the public in terms of self-reporting. I hope coming through COVID, that's one of the lessons we've learned is, if you're sick, you have symptoms, you think you've had a contact, these are the measures you should personally take to try and reduce potential transmission risks, and then the importance of being able to get for testing. We still need to keep promoting it. Certainly MPOX has taught us that. But I think we're in a different place than we were kind of pre-2020 as well.
I agree with you, yeah. And then in terms of, I mean, obviously there will be other emerging viral diseases. We currently are dealing with situations, you know, in Africa, and these surveillance networks are well in place in places where there is more endemic disease. Is there something like, is Canada doing something different now post-pandemic from the COVID pandemic to kind of ramp up surveillance so that we can pick up on some of these emerging viral diseases as well?
Yeah, you know what, I would say so. I mean, I say that in a biased perspective because I'm somebody who, you know, has been able to get grant funding to do some of this work and also works with others who do as well. I think it's kind of a two-sided coin because the one side is, yep, there's been greater investment certainly in surveillance. And I think a greater appreciation that surveillance is actually a science and it belongs in terms of funded research and science. So that's the positive side. The kind of more pessimistic side is much of that surveillance again is based off of grant funding. So, you know, your surveillance networks that you're creating, they're usually coming in with like a 2 to 5 year period where you know that you have sustained funding. After that, it's, you know, you're either going back to try to reapply or hoping somebody else is coming forward to be able to try and sustain the network. I think that's one of the areas where we still need some work is what does, you know, sustained investment look like and how do we sustain researchers or sustain groups to be able to do this type of work on the ground and also ensure that we are doing this in a way that is building capacity and not just kind of providing hands and saying, yeah, you know, we'll do the work. Please just let us have access to, you know, to your country and to all of your equipment and let us have at it. We need to be able to do this from a partnership perspective and ensure that we can move funds to partners rapidly and also appreciate the expertise that those partners often have far greater amounts than what we do.
Yeah. And always it goes down to funding, right? And so the problem we have sometimes with research and even some of these surveillance networks or programs that we're developing, it comes down to funding. And like you mentioned, that having that sustained funding is really important. So there's a lot of discussion in literature in terms of the spillover. So from zoonotic reservoir, we've seen a lot of environmental changes over the last decade, I would say. Constantly, like areas are flooding, we're dealing with global warming, areas that never really had much tick activity. Now we're seeing the spread of that. So your work, obviously, out in Africa, you're working, you know, closely with seeing that zoonotic transmission, and we know that emerging viral diseases commonly kind of present that way. And so in terms of kind of what the potential of this is and what are we doing, like, are there other diseases that you're currently are on the rise or you're looking at, you know, and what kind of surveillance are you doing there?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the easiest one that I think most people will, you know, kind of have top of mind is H5N1 avian influenza, right? So, you know, earlier this year, I can't separate months and years anymore. So I think it was early 2024. We saw the introduction of H5N1 from wild birds into dairy cattle in the U.S. We are continuing to see, you know, movement of the virus through dairy cattle. We've seen some human infections that have accompanied that. Those have been, you know, fairly mild in nature, which has been great. The cattle, it's largely been a self-limiting disease, but we've seen also spillover from those animals into other species like farm cats, but cats that are found on farms. We've seen high fatality rates in those animals. We've seen certainly prior to that, the broad movement of H5N1 globally the last couple of years and really moving and having really profound impacts on marine mammals. all across North America, moving into South America, and now, you know, obviously moving into Antarctica. And I think now every continent has had avian influenza introduction. So those types of events are things we're following. We pretty quickly, when it was established that you could start to look for fragments of H5N1 virus in commercial milk, as FDA reported, we set up an academic network across Canada to start testing retail milk samples, and really just to try and provide where we could, because Canada had not seen any case at that point. We still haven't seen any introduction, but to be able to provide some additional surveillance coverage. So we've been very active there. There's another piece of this, which of course, it's avian influenza. So we know that while birds are really the kind of the reservoir host that we need to focus on, there's a piece of this which is still, what is that risk for people that are in close contact to wild birds? Those that are doing bird handling, those that are hunting, those that are consuming wild birds. So we are working on getting some serial surveillance networks up and running right now to be able to address some of that, to look at exposures over time, to also be able to provide confidence for people that are partaking in these activities, and also to look at infection prevention control mechanisms. Those things continue to be top of mind for tick-borne diseases. You know, right now, you know, obviously, you know, Lyme continues to be a big concern in Canada with kind of greater geographic spread. Powassan virus is top of mind for you know, the kind of, you know, northeasterly direction we've seen coming out of the U.S. and the movement into Canada. But we're also watching other arthropod-borne viruses as well, including dengue. And obviously, you know, still focusing on Zika and chikungunya, and then, you know, working in Crimean Congo in the background of all this, because of the kind of more sustained transmission that we're starting to see, or at least say sustained circulation we're seeing amongst ticks in Europe. You know, we're kind of looking at that movement out of Africa now to additional continents. So the unfortunate reality, I think, for us is I try to be very maneuverable. And I think all of my collaborators trying to be very maneuverable with what we work on. We're pivoting all the time, though. Either we're doing, you know, much better surveillance and we're much more cognizant of what's going on around us, or we're seeing, you know, a greater emergence of these infectious diseases. And I would suggest we're probably seeing the latter. I think we continue to need to be prepared. We continue to need to figure out where we need to do surveillance, what surveillance looks like, and overall what exposure looks like for humans. Again, we kind of tend to focus on, you know, mortality and morbidity for many of these diseases. Mpox is certainly, you know, a kind of top of mind, but of course Ebola and avian influenza and others. But we tend to know about the cases that are presenting. Right.
Yeah.
The piece that we don't understand yet is, how many cases do we not know about, and what does that circulation look like? So for us, a big part of this is trying to get those networks created and try to get a better idea of what exposure and circulation looks like more broadly for emerging infectious diseases overall.
Yeah. And I think, like, even what I've learned, like being an infectious disease physician, right? I was a staff, like right at the peak of the pandemic, a new staff. And so just kind of learning and also going through the whole pandemic and answering questions and really seeing this, even now, the strains evolve. And the variants come through. And I think that's what makes it really challenging. You know, you talked about like pivoting. I think it also makes it very challenging because you see newer strains and newer variants come from these strains that then makes your work so complicated.
Well, and it gets, I think the piece that gets probably the most complicated, to at least in my mind, is communicating back to the public. Like, you know, Mpox, a perfect 100%. Example, when we talk about clade 1B, trying to explain, well, how does clade 1 and clade 2, how do they differ? And then how do the subclades differ? And how does this compare to what we, you know, have seen reported historically? That piece of community engagement and knowledge translation is so important. And I think one of the things coming out of COVID that I hope we appreciated was ensuring that messaging, again, is not a one-size-fits-all. There are communities in Canada, in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, certainly more broadly in the global community, that are disproportionately affected by these viruses, or may also have underlying concerns of, you know, in regards to what their perceived risks are. How do we ensure that information is getting to those communities and is being done in a way that, or communicated in a way that's respectful and transparent based on kind of local customs? Like, it's a big piece for us. We learned in 2020 on the fly. I think now we really have to ensure that we integrate that piece into all the work that we're doing.
Oh yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. And I think definitely, I mean, all of the information that we've provided up till now is factual, but then there's always this component of, you know, you're working at the front line of this, you've seen the surveillance networks. Do you feel like the evolution from 2020 till now, have we evolved as a society to kind of fight the next pandemic? And this is obviously an opinionated question. So it has,
this is the pessimistic side of me coming out now. So yes and no. And I know that that's kind of a, you know, an easy way for me to get out of this. I'm more optimistic because of the fact that things like Mpox right now, we're talking about it. It's on the global stage. We're seeing, you know, kind of rash and very, I should say rash, but expedited movement of vaccines and hopefully sustained funds into the areas of need. The pessimistic side is, yeah, but it took until now to do that, right? We had 20 months prior to this where we knew that this was kind of the trajectory. So I weigh the optimism with some of that pessimism. I think H5 is a perfect example where people immediately picked up on those cases. We had broad testing networks. There have been certainly limitations in the robustness of those networks and the reporting and certainly the acquisition of human data that are related to those farms or those agricultural centers. But I think we're moving forward. And I think the rapidity at which that was done is a good indication that we're in a very different place kind of post 2020. So I'm optimistic from that side. I'm a lot, every time I see an Ebola or even a potential Ebola outbreak being announced, I'm more optimistic because I know that that means vaccine deployment is going to be occurring quickly. And the areas where, you know, we've seen these emergence events in the past, their local capacity for testing is much greater. Mm-hmm. Certainly the folks in DRC, it's kind of like within hours, they're testing, they've got teams moving out. It's a very, very good system. Globally, I still worry about this idea of the division between the global north and the global south. Right. Coming out of 2022 with Mpox, we did very, very well with Mpox containment, certainly in Canada and more broadly amongst non-endemic countries. Cases were curtailed quickly. There's been local transmission underneath that, but that's been, you know, fairly well contained. But we always knew where the source was. And there's that period of saying, well, we still haven't gotten vaccines into Nigeria, into DRC, into other endemic regions. We haven't necessarily built up the surveillance networks or the sustained capacity for testing where, you know, in DRC, we have massive limitations for being able to test samples. Can we do that without finding ourselves in a new emergency to kind of provoke us to then do it? So I think we're getting closer to that, but it's coordination and money. And those are decisions that are made at much higher 100%. Levels than me by much smarter people. So I hope we're getting there. I'm more confident than I was pre-2020, but we have work to do.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I mean, when we look at even cases when Ebola, for instance, back in 2013 and that time, you know, that we've learned a lot since then as well. But even at that point, I feel like we were able to contain the infection from becoming a pandemic. Yeah. And I think some of it is familiarity, right? So like we talked about the H5N1 response, probably some of our knowledge back from H1N1 outbreaks probably helped us at that time too. And so we know way more information than we did previously. And I think the real thing is the importance. We know the importance of being aware that something like this is out there and that we have surveillance networks, you know, in place so that if there is any case that is reported outside of kind of that endemic area, it's picked up quickly. And like you said, deployment is quicker. So it does make you feel a little bit better that things are in the works.
And I think the other piece of this too is that all this is being done in a multidisciplinary fashion, right? I think one of the things that's come through during the pandemic is you have this olive branch that's been extended across between healthcare workers, physicians, physician researchers, social scientists, people that are working in natural sciences. Like everybody is kind of banding together to figure out how can we build teams to combat this from a very kind of, you know, kind of broad brush. I think we're doing better in that realm. And that's important. That way, at the very least, that information is able to get across all these different communities much faster, and ensure that we're also not kind of missing areas within research when we have the opportunities to do very focused investigations.
Yeah, and you make a very valid point about the multidisciplinary approach. I mean, even coming from during COVID and having kind of vaccine programs and vaccine development was a key thing at that time. And we saw that approach happen over, several months, within like 6 months, I would say, that where we were able to, have researchers come together, have companies, help with production and deployment of these vaccines. So it does
And
make you
clinical
feel,
trials and all these things. Like it's, you know,
yeah, I
I
mean, it
think
has to,
it's
yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah, and then coming from like I think not only surveillance but then lab testing, because that's
Yes.
huge too, right? So
Oh, absolutely.
yeah, and is there been a lot of kind of in the microbiology world, because I'm away from that, although I work very closely with my colleagues in micro, is there are there advancements in terms of, I mean, I think like GeneXpert was something that has obviously revolutionized. PCR has obviously changed our world. And then there's the quicker diagnostics. But is there anything that's emerged since the pandemic that you would say is going to be helpful in the future?
I think one of the things that we learned coming through the pandemic game, kind of, I'm just a virologist, right? So,
Yeah.
just kind of my naive viewpoint, but just thinking the idea of like rapid antigen testing, that was something that, for years people had talked about. We had seen some amount of deployment of it. Then 2020 hits and we have, massive global deployment of rapid antigen tests. The ability to be able to do that type of testing on the spot change things, I think, insurmountably, because this was also a technology that didn't require a constant power source, and could be done really in very, very resource limited
Yeah.
areas. So I think there's a move towards that. Our current situation with mpox, we're still trying to figure out how we can do rapid testing. PCR is limited. We have to appreciate many of the areas that are hotspots for emerging infectious diseases. Largely are very resource limited settings and tend to be very remote settings or rural settings. So it's often difficult to be able to kind of deploy infrastructure that requires constant power sources. But things like rapid antigen tests, if we can get those deployed and if we can identify those cases faster, these are technologies that can be used by individuals that don't have medical training or don't require diagnostic training outside of being able to understand,
Right.
what the lines mean and what, the potential confounding variables might be. That faster ability to be able to identify a suspected case to then do
Yeah.
follow-up testing, I think will really revolutionize things.
I agree with you. I mean, I see that even currently with COVID too, that we still have these antigen tests that general public can use and can really identify, okay, I shouldn't go to work or I shouldn't be around people if this is positive, which then, takes you to the next step, which is then goes into prevention because we have less circulating strain.
And can reduce the stigma associated with having to go somewhere for testing, right? I
100%.
mean, I think that's a big piece of me, especially like mpox with what we're seeing in Congo with the link back to sex work or to those that identify as GBM-SAM. It's a heavy stigma attached with that. So, being able to have testing that can be done in the home that then pushes somebody to go to a local healthcare clinic or gives them the impetus to do that, I think is good. Being able, we still need to figure out the whole idea of how we can take kind of self-testing to be able to then be integrated into like national databases, or at least be recorded data of just positives or negatives. That's a bigger question, but I think we're moving towards something that is easier for the user.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're doing a fantastic job out there. It's commendable to see that you have a huge team and your team is, looking at such great work like surveillance and the long-term effects as well, because I think that's really important to kind of evaluate. And so I think your work out in Africa, but then also the work that you're doing locally as well, I think is super helpful. And folks like yourself are the ones that are, the reasons why we're, optimistic that we are getting closer and closer to being more prepared. And obviously, there's holes in every system, and it takes time to learn how to fill some of those holes. So, but after having this conversation with you, I definitely feel my answer would be that we are definitely more prepared than we were back in 2020.
I appreciate that. It's humbling. I'll use it in my next annual performance review. But I say the feeling is absolutely equal on my side for our healthcare workers. You all have been, taking it on the chin with COVID and Mpox and everything in between. The work that all of you have been doing, and as well the work on community engagement, public engagement, the stuff that you're doing with podcasts like this for the public, it makes a massive difference for us as well. So very, very much appreciated.
Again, it's working together, right? And so exactly. I think we learned that from the pandemic, and that's what's going to help. It's great to see all of your work. And I honestly, it was a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. We had a fantastic previous episode on Mpox. Everybody will tune into that, I'm sure. And then we might see you again on the podcast.
Or hopefully there won't be another outbreak and everything's fine.
There you go. Nice chatting. Thanks so
Thank
much.
You.
Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Kinderchuk, for joining us again. Have an episode suggestion? Email thecanadianbreakpoint@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on X at CA Breakpoint for updates. See you again soon at the Canadian Breakpoint.